the Abelian Higgs model. And just to put it in perspective, the strategy that we've embarked on is building up the Higgs mechanism on our way to the standard model, but starting from very simple models, and then we'll get to the standard model. It's just a question of what symmetry to put into the theory. We started out with a discrete symmetry, then we talked about a global U1 symmetry. Now we're going to cover a local U1 symmetry, and the standard model will be slightly more complex. So we had been discussing the Abelian Higgs model, which is just the theory of a complex scalar plus a local U1 gauge symmetry. And what we showed last time is that, the Lagrangian is very simple. And because this parameter mu squared, as I've written it here, is positive, we have spontaneous symmetry breaking, meaning that the Hamiltonian is minimized when the potential is minimized when this field phi acquires a vacuum expectation value. This spontaneously gives rise to a mass term for our photon, for the gauge boson in the theory. So what we did last time is, so we found what the vacuum expectation value was. It was, mu squared over lambda, square root. And then we plugged in our shifted field, shifted with respect to this vacuum expectation value. So we wrote our complex field as the VEV plus a real field phi 1 prime plus I phi 2 prime all over square root 2. We showed that plugging that in, the term in the Lagrangian where you have G and A mu times where phi is equal to the VEV gives rise to a mass term. But we also have these weird terms which mix together the gauge field and the derivative of phi 2 prime. So there's actually a simple way to get rid of those weird terms and put the kinetic term in canonical form. Is if we plug in a different parameterization of the shifted fields, instead of expanding it in Cartesian coordinates, the real and imaginary parts of the field, we can expand it in polar coordinates. So let's instead plug in the following. So I'll write phi as 1 over the square root of 2 times the VEV plus a field little h. So that's the magnitude of the fields. And then I just need to multiply by a phase, e to the I c over v. So the two fields here, in this case, I have two real fields, phi 1 and phi 2. Here I also have two real fields, which I'll call h and C. This field little h will be the Higgs boson in the theory. We can actually, before we plug this in, we can actually make it even simpler. Remember, we have still this gauge transformation to play around with. Gauge transformation acting on phi will shift phi by a phase. So I can actually use that gauge transformation to eliminate this extra phase here, which depends on the field. So I have phi goes to e to the minus I c over v times phi. And so this is just simply 1 over square root 2 times v plus h. This choice here where we use a gauge transformation to eliminate the phase is known as unitary gauge. Then also the gauge field also transforms. So A will go into some other gauge field A prime, which is just A mu plus 1 over g times v times the derivative of c. Okay? So we did this gauge transformation. Now let's compute the covariant derivative. So d mu phi is just d mu plus I g a mu phi. And so now, after I do the gauge transformation, it's just 1 over square root 2 d mu plus I g a mu prime. And then I have v plus h here. So, all right. So what we've done is we've eliminated c completely from the Lagrangian. Doesn't appear in the covariant derivative. Doesn't appear, of course, in any of the other terms in the Lagrangian either. So let's write down the Lagrangian. We have 1 half, and then the covariant derivative term, d mu plus I g a mu prime, and then I have v plus h squared. I have plus mu squared over 2 v plus h squared minus lambda over 4 v plus h to the fourth. And I have 1 fourth f mu nu. I don't need to put primes on f mu nu. It's invariant under the gauge transformation. So now I can, of course, just drop the prime. There's no reason to keep a prime here. Just a name. So let's drop the primes. And let me just expand out everything that I have. So first, I have the kinetic term for the Higgs, the Higgs field. So that just comes from this term acting on h. When the derivative acts on the VEV, of course, you get 0 since the VEV is just a constant. I have minus mu squared h squared, and minus 1 fourth f mu nu. I also acquire a mass term for the gauge boson. That just comes from the term where I have the VEV squared and the gauge field squared. So that gives me a term that looks like this, 1 half g squared v squared a mu a nu. And then there's no cross term. There's no term which I had before, which involves, for example, the gauge field times the derivative of mu, because when you expand everything out, those terms will cancel, just because you'll have I here and then minus I for the other term. Okay. So these terms here that I've written down would correspond to the free part of the Lagrangian, but then I have interactions as well. So let me just write it as the interactions. So before I write down the interactions, we can now read off what are the masses of the fields that we have in the theory. So we have the Higgs field. So I would write mh squared is just equal to 2 times mu squared, or mh is just the square root of 2 mu. And then we have the vector boson mass. Ma squared is just g squared v squared. So then Ma is just g times the VEV. Okay. Now let me write down the interactions. So again, this is just expanding everything out in this line here, and just including all of the terms that are cubic or quartic in all of the fields. So those terms include the following. I have g squared v times a mu a mu times h. I have a 1/2 g squared h squared a mu a mu. I have a minus lambda times v times h cubed. And then I have minus lambda over v h to the fourth. So those are all of the interactions. Now, a couple things magical are going on here. In general, if I just wrote down an arbitrary Lagrangian involving all of these fields, every single coefficient would be an arbitrary number. But in this theory, because we're acquiring these interactions through spontaneous symmetry breaking, all of the coefficients in front of all of these different interactions are well defined in terms of a finite number of parameters. And so, in fact, you can describe all four of these different numbers just in terms of the masses which appear in the free Lagrangian, plus lambda, for example, or you could have picked the VEV. So all the coefficients are fixed in terms of lambda plus the masses. In this case, that's MA and MH. Okay? So even though spontaneous symmetry breaking is destroying the gauge symmetry that we started with, it remembers that it came from a gauge theory, and that's manifested in the relationship between the different couplings. Now, the other interesting thing that happened is that we completely removed one of the degrees of freedom from the Lagrangian. We had this real field C, which completely vanished. And it makes sense that it vanished. So we had what's called the would-be Goldstone boson. The reason I call it the would-be Goldstone boson is because in the global theory, this degree of freedom Xi would be the Goldstone boson in the theory. We would have a massless degree of freedom. But in this case, it does not appear. And what we say is that it gets eaten by the gauge field. And it's actually necessary that this occurs. Because when we started out the theory, we had a massless vector fields, which has two degrees of freedom. There are two polarizations for the photon. And then we also started with a complex scalar fields. Which has also two degrees of freedom. There was the real and imaginary part, or the magnitude and the phase, which were both parameterized by real fields. And so one of these was C, and the other one was the Higgs field, little h. And so in our final theory, what we have is a massive gauge boson plus our Higgs field h, which is a real scalar. A massive vector boson has three polarizations, so there's 3 degrees of freedom. And our real scalar, of course, just has 1 degree of freedom. So throughout this process, the number of degrees of freedom is conserved. The Goldstone boson that we would have had gets eaten to become the longitudinal polarization for our now massive vector fields. Okay, so what we've shown in this model is how spontaneous symmetry breaking can give mass to a vector boson. Now, we had another problem as well. I argue that in the standard model, we have to deal with fermions that have chiral gauge interactions. And if you have a gauge symmetry that's chiral, it forbids the existence of a mass term. And so all of the fermions in the standard model, like the electron, should be massless according to the gauge symmetry, but of course it's not the case. But it turns out that spontaneous symmetry breaking can also give masses to the fermions as well, even in a chiral theory. And so I want to show how that will work right now. So let's talk about the fermion masses. So we're going to take our abelian Higgs model, and we'll just add a fermion species. And I'll just call it psi. I'm going to assume that it has chiral gauge couplings. So that means that the left and right-handed components transform differently under the gauge transformation. And so we showed before that a mass term in the Lagrangian, if we just put it in by hand, because it involves the left and right-handed components mixed together, this is not gauge invariant, and so this mass term would be forbidden. Okay, so let me introduce a little bit of notation here. I'm going to show you how we can generate such a mass term through our complex scalar field phi and spontaneous symmetry breaking. So let's so we have our gauge coupling, which we called little g. Let me also introduce the charge of all the different fields in the theory as q. So for example, I have three different fields. I have my scalar fields, and then I have the right and left-handed fermion fields. And I have to pick what are the charges of all of these fields in units of g. And so that means what are these values, capital Q. And so for phi, I wrote down the covariant derivative up here. And so effectively, what I did by this choice is I took the charge of this field's q to be plus 1 by writing the covariant derivative like that. So let me just keep that to be consistent. But then there's some freedom in what I choose for the charges of q left and q right. So in general, these can have an arbitrary charge q left, and this will have another charge q right. When we were discussing gauge invariance of the fermion mass terms before, we introduced different gauge couplings for the two different fields, g left and g right. And so in that notation, what I called g left before would just be q left times g, and g right before would be q right times g. So then I can write down the gauge transformations. So phi goes to e to the minus ig q phi times alpha phi. And psi left and psi right go to e to the minus g q left or right times alpha times psi left or psi right. OK. So in principle, all of these different charges can be completely arbitrary. But there's one particular choice that you can make for these different charges that allows you to write down a brand new term in the Lagrangian that you couldn't write down before. So if we assume the following, that q left is equal to q right plus q phi, then we can write down the following. We can introduce another term in the Lagrangian known as the Yukawa coupling, which has the form y is the coupling constant. Then I have psi left bar psi right times phi plus Hermitian conjugate. So for this particular choice of the charges, this term is allowed, and I can write it down. You might ask, why should I assume that this is true? Well, if it wasn't true, then I wouldn't be able to write this term down, and then I couldn't generate the fermion masses like I want. Okay. So this term is gauge invariant. I think it's easy to see that it is. So now let's see what happens to this term after spontaneous symmetry breaking. So first thing, we take this term in the Lagrange and we can perform a gauge transformation in all the fields to put it into unitary gauge, such that the field phi can be written as follows. One over square root two times V plus H. Then my Yukawa term is minus y times psi left psi right times 1 over square root 2 times v plus h plus Hermitian conjugate. And then if I expand all of this out, the terms proportional to the VEV will give me what looks like a fermion mass. So I'll have y times v over square root 2 times psi bar left, psi right, psi bar right, psi left. And then the term proportional to the Higgs fields gives me y over square root 2 times the Higgs field, psi bar left, psi right, plus psi bar right, psi left. And so that is just minus, so I can write it as a mass for my fermion, times psi bar psi, and then a Yukawa coupling as follows. And so now my fermion mass is just y times the VEV divided by square root 2. So we've successfully generated a mass or fermion fields through a gauge invariant coupling, a gauge invariant Yukawa coupling. But again, in an arbitrary theory, the mass of the fermion is not necessarily related to the coupling of a scalar to the fermion. But now that we're doing everything with spontaneous symmetry breaking, those two things are related. Once I know the VEV, I can predict the Yukawa coupling in terms of the mass, or vice versa. So those two couplings, the mass and the coupling, are related to each other. So what we've shown is that we started with a gauge invariant theory, but through spontaneous symmetry breaking, we can generate terms in the Lagrangian that are not gauge invariant. And so what we've done goes under the name of the Higgs mechanism. And so we've used spontaneous symmetry breaking. To generate terms in the Lagrangian that aren't gauge invariants. Now, this has two very important implications. And so first of all, as I've argued as we've gone along, the different parameters appearing in the Lagrangian are all related to each other. So the parameters in the Lagrangian are not all independent. I can summarize all of them in terms of a fewer number of independent parameters. And that is the manifestation that the theory was originally gauge invariant. The other important implication is that we have this sort of leftover degree of freedom, which is the Higgs field, H. So that's also a prediction of spontaneous symmetry breaking. If we want to generate these gauge non-invariant terms in the Lagrangian through spontaneous symmetry breaking, we'll always have this leftover degree of freedom, which is a physical field. And so that was originally the prediction. We should go and look for this thing to confirm that spontaneous symmetry breaking occurs in nature with respect to the standard model. Spontaneous symmetry breaking also fixes this issue of renormalizability, which I mentioned before. We show that we considered the scattering of two fermions, and we show that this was divergence. And this divergent necessitated the introduction of non-renormalizable operators in the Lagrangian in order to cancel off. If we generate these gauge non-invariant terms in the Lagrangian through spontaneous symmetry breaking, this divergence ends up being canceled off, which I'll show you now. So I just want to recap this box diagram that I wrote down before. So we are considering the scattering process of two fermions. And we were looking at like these two diagrams added together. All right, and then we had some loop momentum K going around the loop. So we just did a kind of a simple power counting argument. So the whole thing scales like g to the fourth. G is just the coupling at every vertex. Then we had to integrate over the loop momenta, d4k over 2 pi to the fourth, up to some cutoff. We had two powers of a fermion propagator. So that looked like k slash plus m psi over k squared. Squared. And then we had two powers of this gauge boson propagator. And the most divergent part of that propagator was the part that was proportional to k mu, k nu. So I'll just keep that. We had k mu, k nu. Then there was a part in the denominator that went like k squared. And then this term in the numerator, k mu, k nu, was over ma squared. So this is all a little schematic. I'm only keeping the leading divergent terms that will blow up as we take the integral to infinity. So what we also argued is that the term involving the k slash here would end up canceling off once you add these two diagrams together. So I'm only left with the term proportional to m psi. And so then at the end of the day, we had something schematically as follows. We had g to the fourth. We had m psi squared. And then we have MA, 1 over MA to the 4th. So now, because we're generating these masses through spontaneous symmetry breaking, I can express these masses in terms of the Yukawa couplings in the VEV, or the gauge coupling in the VEV. So MA was just G times the VEV, and so that G to the 4th will cancel this G to the 4th, and I'll just be left with 1 over the VEV to the 4th. This one went like Yukawa times the VEV, and so I'll have Yukawa squared times VEV squared. Some powers of the VEV will cancel, and I'll just be left over with something proportional to y squared over the VEV squared. Then I also have the powers of k appearing in the integrand. So it's a log divergence, and so I'll get something that looks like the log of lambda squared. And so that divergence will carry over like this. So this was the argument that we made before. Now, as I mentioned, the prediction of spontaneous symmetry breaking is that we have this extra degree of freedom in the theory. That means we have more diagrams to compute. We can exchange not just the vector boson, but we can also exchange Higgs bosons. So I should include also some extra diagrams, like this. Plus various permutations. So now I should include this and add that together, and we'll see what we get. So we're going to be kind of schematic about this. We have two gauge couplings. So I have G squared. We have two factors of the Yukawa coupling. So we have Y squared. We have an integral, d4k over 2 pi to the 4th. Now we have two factors of the fermion propagator. And the argument with the fermion propagator is not so subtle as it is in this case. I can just keep the leading k dependence. And so that's just k slash over k squared. And then we should square that. Then we have one gauge boson propagator. So I should write down k mu, k nu, over k squared, ma squared. And then I have one Higgs boson propagator. It's just a real scalar. So that would look like 1 over k squared. So first, let me count the powers of the coupling. I have g squared times y squared. And then in the denominator, I have ma squared, which is g squared times the VEV squared. The g's will cancel. And again, I'll just have a factor of y squared over v squared. The divergence we can count the powers of k to figure out how it diverges as we take the integral to infinity, or as we evaluate it at a cutoff. So let's see. This would look like 1 over k squared. This is 1 over k squared, so we have 1 over k to the 4th. This is 0 in powers of k. So d4k times 1 over k to the 4th gives us a log divergence. So this is exactly what we would need to cancel off the divergence that that arose over here. And I have, of course, I'm being very schematic with this. But if you had done a legit calculation where you put in all of the correct numerical factors and actually calculated all of the diagrams, now them together, you could verify that this cancellation actually occurs. But I just want to emphasize the important point that it's really because you have this relationship between couplings and masses appearing in the theory that the cancellation can occur. And we are restored with a renormalizable theory in the end of the day. So the divergence is canceled because the couplings and masses are related. OK. As I mentioned before, I'm just going to reiterate this again. The prediction from the spontaneously broken gauge theory is that we have this extra Higgs scalar H, and the couplings of the scalar are related to the masses of gauge bosons and fermions. Question?
Where does the relative minus sign between the two contributions come from?
To be honest, I'm not too sure. But minus signs can come from anywhere. So we have this extra scalar H, and we're going to compute a lot of the properties of the Higgs boson in the standard model. But just to sort of whet your appetite, let me just write down how it works in this abelian Higgs model. So we have our Higgs boson. We can calculate all of the Feynman rules for the Higgs boson now that we have the Lagrangian. So for example, I could consider the Higgs boson coupling two vector bosons, a mu, a nu. The Feynman rule would be 2 times I times ma squared divided by the VeV times eta mu nu. Or we could have the Higgs coupling two fermions. And this coupling is just I times m psi divided by the VeV. A question you may have is, where does the VeV come from? When we get to the standard model, we're going to show that the numerical value of the VeV is fixed. It's actually just fixed in terms of Fermi's constant. So V is a known quantity. So once we know V, and if we know the masses of the fermions and the gauge bosons in the standard model, namely the W and the Z, then we know precisely the coefficients in front of all of these Feynman rules. So it's actually a very predictive theory. Not only do we want to show that the Higgs boson exists and that it decays sort of in this fashion through these Feynman rules, but it's very predictive. The precise coefficient governing the Feynman rules for those decays will be given precisely in terms of the masses of the corresponding fermions. So in the end of the day, spontaneous symmetry breaking is very predictive, and everything can be tested. And it turns out to work. Okay. So that was the abelian Higgs model. It had to do with a local gauge symmetry, a local U1 abelian gauge symmetry. The standard model is not so simple. For the standard model, we need to think about non-abelian gauge symmetries. In particular, the group to consider is SU2 cross U1. And you're going to do that case for homework. Okay? But now we're going to do a simpler case where we only have SU2. So this will be the non-abelian Higgs model. And the philosophy will be very similar to what we did with the abelian Higgs model. But the main difference is now we're going to have an SU2 gauge theory plus complex scalar doublet, which I'll write as capital phi. And it's a fundamental under SU2. And so I should write it as a doublet, phi 1, phi 2. Each one of those fields is a complex field. So let me write down the Lagrangian. So I'll have a covariant derivative. And I have a potential. for phi. And then I have the gauge part. So 1/2 times the trace of f mu nu. The covariant derivative is defined as follows. So I have some generator, TA, and then I have a gauge field, A mu, labeled by A, with the gauge index. And all of that is a matrix that acts on this doublet phi. The generator is just the Pauli matrix divided by 2. I need to write down some other things. Right. The field strength tensor is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. And then for a non-abelian gauge field, there's an extra term involving a structure constant, and then a mu a nu with gauge indices a, b, c, and d as follows. Okay? And then lastly, we have the potential. And this will look very similar to what we had for the Abelian-Higgs model, minus mu squared phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. And this is the most general renormalizable potential we can have. Can't have a cubic term because it would violate the gauge symmetry. So I'm assuming that this parameter that I've written here, mu squared, is positive, so that we have spontaneous symmetry breaking occurring. So we'll take mu squared to be positive. And we want to find where the minimum of the potential is. It's identical to the case of the Abelian-Higgs model. We want where phi dagger phi is equal to what I'll write as v squared over 2, where v is the square root of m squared divided by lambda. Okay. Okay, so similar to the Abelian-Higgs model, we want to use a gauge transformation to simplify the form that phi will take instead of having two complex degrees of freedom to worry about. So what we'll do is we can work in unitary gauge. And so that means that we perform a gauge transformation. So in principle, in this doublet, there are four real degrees of freedom. By performing a gauge transformation, or I should say, we can write this as phi 1 real plus phi 1 imaginary times I, phi 2 real plus I, phi 2 imaginary. This would be writing the fields in Cartesian coordinates. We can also write it as well in similar to a polar coordinates that we did before. And here's how we would do that. So we have e to the I, then we have the generator times ca of x divided by the vev, acting on the following, 0 v plus h of x divided by square root of 2. And so just like here, I had 4 real degrees of freedom. Here I also have 4 real degrees of freedom. 3 of them are the fields appearing in this phase, this non-abelian phase. And 1 is left over inside of the doublet. So we have real fields C1 through C3 and H. So now we can rotate away all of these 3 fields C using a gauge transformation. So we'll take phi, and then we'll just multiply it by exactly the opposite that we had here to cancel it off. So this is our gauge transformation. And then the things that are left over, sorry, this is capital phi. And what's left over is just 0 v plus h over the square root of 2 as follows. So this is our field in unitary gauge. So what I want to do next is write down the covariant derivative and see how this generates a mass for our vector bosons. So the Lagrangian includes this covariant derivative term, which I can just write as d mu phi squared. So I have, okay, let me just write this out. D mu phi dagger, d mu phi. And I'll plug in what we have. So first, I should be multiplying this part as a row vector. So I'll have a 1 half from the square root of 2 squared. V of 0, comma v plus h. Then I'll have the stuff appearing from the covariant derivative. And the derivative has to act on the left, because I have, I'm talking about this covariant derivative here. So I have d mu acting on the left minus ig a mu a. Then I will have this covariant derivative, d mu acting on the right plus ig T B A mu B acting on 0 V plus H. I have to be careful a little bit because you know, these two things are matrices, so I can't mess around with their order. Now let me just expand this. So first of all, I have let's focus on the derivative terms. The derivatives, of course, will only act on the h parts, since v is a constant. And so that will just leave me with 1/2 times the kinetic term for the Higgs field. Now I have the gauge bosons terms appearing here. And that will look as follows. So I'll have g squared over 8. The reason is that it's an 8 is because I have a 1/2 here. And then all of my generators are the Pauli matrices divided by 2. And so I have divided by 2 squared, which gives me a factor of 8. Now, when I multiply my gauge fields times a Pauli matrix, I'll get the following. So I have A3 mu A1 mu minus I A2 mu A1 mu plus I A2 mu, and then minus A3 mu, like this. So these are just the three components of my gauge field contracted into the corresponding Pauli matrices. That was this. Then I have the same thing over here, so I'll just square that. Important. Then on this side, I have 0, comma v plus h. And then over here, I have a row or a column 0, v plus h, like this. OK, you also have cross terms. The cross terms will all cancel off, because one of them will have an I, the other one will have a minus I. Now, if I expand out all of these matrices and multiply everything together, I get the following. I have 1/2 d mu h squared plus g squared over 8 times v plus h squared. And I actually, when I multiply the two matrices, I just get the sum of all the different components squared. So I'll have a mu 1 plus a mu 2 a2 mu plus a mu 3 a3 mu, like this. So this is what I would get at the end of the day. And then I can keep going, simplify it further. I have plus 1/2 dv over 2 squared times a mu a mu. Now I'm just implicitly summing over the different components. And then I multiply this by 1 plus h over v squared. OK. So that's as simplified as I can make it. And so you can see that even in this non-abelian model, we're still generating mass terms for our gauge bosons. We have three gauge bosons. I can write them as a mu 1, a mu 2, and a mu 3. And they all have the same mass. Which is MA, and that would just be GV over 2. We started out with three extra fields C. All three of those fields, those would-be Goldstone bosons, get eaten. And each one of those gives the longitudinal part for each of these three vector bosons. So we can count the degrees of freedom if you like. So we started out with three massless photons. And so that's 3 times 2 degrees of freedom. And then we had 4 scalar degrees of freedom. So we had one complex doublet. this was 4 real degrees of freedom. Three of these were for the C fields, and then one of them was for the Higgs fields, little h. And then at the end of the day, we had 3 massive gauge bosons. Which is 3 times 3 degrees of freedom plus 1 real scalar, which is 1 degree of freedom. So we started out with 6 plus 4 is 10. We finish with 3 times 3 is 9 plus 1 is 10. So the number of degrees of freedom is the same. These 3 fields get eaten to become the longitudinal parts, or in other words, to give mass to the massless vector fields. Okay, so it's starting to look a little bit like the standard model. The standard model we know has 3 massive gauge bosons, the W plus, the W minus, and the Z. Here we have 3 massive vector bosons. However, we know that the W and the Z have a different mass. Here all 3 have the same mass. Also in the standard model we have a photon. So 1 gauge boson is massless. Here we don't have a massless gauge boson. Also in the standard model, there are 8 massless gluons. We don't have 8 massive gluons so far. So we're not quite to the standard model, but you can see how the standard model is starting to take shape. Okay. So that's all I wanted to cover for today. The plan for you is that you're going to have to work out what is the correct non-abelian gauge symmetry for the standard model. It turns out to be SU2 cross U1, and it's a homework exercise to repeat this process for that particular gauge symmetry. On Monday, I'm going to assume that you've done that exercise, so I apologize for that. But we're going to introduce the standard model Lagrangian and write down all of the different interactions and all of the different fields. And so I'm just mentioning this because it would be a good idea if you at least looked at this homework assignment over the weekend. If you solve it, then you'll be even in better shape.